Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She's currently a weekly columnist for the American Prospect and a contributor to SiriusXM Progress. And the latest article at the American Prospect is On the Road to Kleptocracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Adele. And in this sort of interregnum between Christmas and the New Year, looking back over the year, to my mind, one of the most significant things that happened this year, and it happened literally the day after Donald Trump's inauguration, was this spontaneous manifestation of millions of women across the United States and around the world protesting and organizing. I mean, the organization of the event itself was sudden and spontaneous. And then gradually throughout this year, you get the impression that women in general are getting more mobilized and more focused on politics. Many, many women are running on the Democratic ticket. And you also have this Me Too movement burgeoning, which is changing the workplace across this country in both corporate America, in the government, in the Congress, and particularly here in Hollywood in the entertainment business.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think that, you know, women started protesting the day after the inauguration and really haven't stopped since. Just because we don't see the streets filled with women doesn't mean they're not still protesting. And especially, I think we have to say, women of color have been doing just amazing work as ground organizers and keeping the movement going. But women have been the people behind the resistance. And if you look at, you know, even the election of certain men has been, you know, in many ways a woman's project, right? The whole Doug Jones election in Alabama. African-American women did so much of the organizing that did the turnout, you know, created the voter turnout that gave Jones that victory. And, you know, I think, you know, we've reached a new moment in American history. It doesn't mean, you know, misogyny is by any means dead and the patriarchy still unfortunately lives, but but it's, things are different.
Well, obviously, you know, you could make the argument that there's Newton's law is at play in the political world. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And
right.
I don't think we've ever had such a reactionary and dangerous and destructive president in the history of this country. And it's certainly not going unnoticed. But is it your sense, though, that, I mean, the divide is already there, the male-female divide in this country between the Democrats and the Republicans. Something like 60% of male Americans vote Republican and about 60-something plus percent of female Americans vote Democrat. So
right.
Do we already have the mummy and daddy party to begin with?
Well, I mean, to a certain extent, that's true. But if you break it out by demographics, it gets, you know, by, like, say, racial demographics, it gets more complicated, right? Or even marital status. You know, married women tend to vote Republican, married white women. White women in general, you know, usually, at the very least, a narrow majority will vote Republican. So, you know, it depends. It always depends on which women you're talking about in terms of, you know, ascribing a party identity to gender identity. However, I do think that, you know, there's no mistaking that the Republican Party is indeed the party of white patriarchy. That's what it is. That's part of its brand. And in fact, you know, I don't think that people voted for Donald Trump in spite of his misogyny. I think people voted for him in part because of his misogyny, and that includes some white women.
Well, but there are also some white women in Alabama who voted against him because they had daughters. So that leads me to wonder if there is some ripe pickings for the Democrats in terms of disaffected Republicans, because their party has been captured by Stephen Bannon's white nationalists and Tea Party nativists.
Right.
And the traditional Republicans are, you know, strangers in their own land, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's going to get any different. It's going to get worse for them. So I'm wondering whether there is, when you do a sort of an objective analysis of the body politic in this country, you always come to the conclusion that the center of gravity is like center right in America. So do you think there's any way to establish a kind of new center right party like Macron did out of nowhere in France?
Mm.
In this case, the Democrats peeling off a whole bunch of disaffected Republicans, or is the landscape simply just too tribal?
I think the landscape is so roiled at this point. I mean, it's undulating, that there's no need for the Dems to go center right to pick up disaffected Republicans. I think that, and I don't believe that America is essentially a center-right nation. If you poll people on their actual positions on things like what we would have come to be known in pundit land as entitlements, whether it's, you know, Social Security or Medicare or even a social safety net for the poor, people, you know, majorities of people come down in favor of those positions. You know, you would think America was, you know, on the verge of a socialist revolution. It's just that when you get into the, as you say, the tribal party identities, that people align themselves differently. So I think that Democrats would do well to, you know, stick to the left positions of you know, equal rights for all people, of protecting the safety net, of trying to go for universal health insurance. I think I really don't think it's pie in the sky to think that Democrats can peel off swing voters with those positions, especially given, you know, the recoiling that people who are from you know, polite white society are having at this moment vis-a-vis Trump. We saw this in Alabama, where educated white people went for Doug Jones, and many of them are people who are believed to have voted Republican before that. So I think that the trick for the Democrats is not to go seeking, you know, for these elusive Republicans, but to enlarge their own electorate by turning out their coalition. And that's, you know, that's what we saw happen in Alabama. And although that was, you know, a unique circumstance in certain ways, you know, turning out your own people is a time-tested model. And it's something that the Hillary Clinton campaign did not do well.
And again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She's currently a weekly columnist for the American Prospect and a contributor to SiriusXM Progress. And her latest article at the American Prospect is On the Road to Kleptocracy. So in terms, though, of, I mean, there's no question that I mentioned earlier that a number of women are entering the political fray on the Democratic side. And there's a 25-year-old young woman as the head of the Democratic Party in Oklahoma who's managing to flip a bunch of local and state seats in a very red state. So something's happening out there. How do you think the Me Too, you know, movement plays into this? Because you can't help feeling that it's almost, by definition, an expression of women's liberation.
It's an expression of women's liberation. It's an expression of women finding their power. And I think that that's where those two things go together, Ian. I think you're quite correct in your observation that these two things are related. But I do believe that the relationship is with women finding their power. Women are so accustomed to not being heard that they often have not spoken up, that we often have not spoken up. There's a new generation of women who are not going to settle for that. You know, it's interesting, even, you know, feminists of my generation, you know, would have found it unthinkable to, you know, to go up such powerful up against such powerful man as, say, Harvey Weinstein. I mean, what Anita Hill did in taking on Clarence Thomas at the time that she did it in the early 1990s is it boggles the mind to think about how alone she was at that moment. You know. So I do think it is about women claiming their power. I think they, you know, women are understanding that they are the people who turn out the vote and who organize their communities. And, you know, they're ready to claim some credit for that.
But given that the sexual predators and sexual harassers, in terms of the ones that have been busted in politics, are pretty even, aren't they, in terms of the number of Democrats and number
sure.
of Republicans?
Patriarchy knows no party.
So I guess the difference between the Democrats and Republicans is on the other side. It'd be the closeted gay men. The Republicans seem to have a lock on that one.
Yes, I think you're quite right.
Right. But on the other side, they're equal opportunity backside pinchers, right? I mean, old Tangerine Hair, Strom Thurmond, he used to regularly, you know, like Barbara Boxer and all the women in the Senate, he was always grabbing them in the elevators, you know.
Right.
I mean, they sort of put up with it for the longest time as though it was just bad behavior or even expectedly bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But what changed that? What was that turning point?
I think the turning point was the election of Donald Trump after the you know, the Access Hollywood tape of him, you know, talking about grabbing women's genitals, you know, came out, and he got elected anyway. And he got elected anyway because a lot of people thought Hillary Clinton had it locked up. And, you know, and I have to say that there were some very, you know, what people we think of as good progressive journalists who were advancing that narrative because they were too smart by half. In looking at the polls and not looking at how the landscape was changing around Trump. So the fact of this guy getting elected with that history and then setting about paying off his religious right buddies who turned out their voters for him by giving away women's rights.
And by putting the Pence on the ticket.
Yes, and that's exactly right. Mike Pence is, you know, I mean, that's his brand, is all about ending a woman's reproductive rights and putting her back in her place. I think that the rage, the combined rage with having seen Hillary Clinton treated the way that she was treated by male journalists, throughout the campaign, and several of whom, by the way, turned out to be sexual assaulters and harassers.
Matt Lauer being high on the list, right?
Very high on the list. His sexism in that that forum that he moderated was just, you know, on display, where he talked over her, he wouldn't let her answer a question, and all he wanted to talk about was her emails. And then he went real soft on Donald Trump. Mark Halperin was another one. The next day, Mark Halperin was on Morning Joe talking about how terrible Hillary Clinton performed and how great Matt Lauer was as a moderator. I mean, these are the people who, you know, mediated this election for people. I mean, the rage that women had been building in women, and then, you know, folks who did not go to the polls because they assumed that Hillary Clinton had it locked up. I mean, there were a fair number of those people who turned out in the streets on January 20th, you know, and they're not going to be fooled again. So I think that you've had this rage building among women for a year now, for more than a year, and there was just a moment where it just took one woman to go after one powerful man and the dam broke.
Well, when you mentioned the Access Hollywood tape being a turning point, Adele Stan, of course, interestingly enough, something else was at play there, and that is another infamous sexual harasser who's living in the Ecuadorian embassy in London and working for the Russians.
Yes.
He dutifully put out this data dump, WikiLeaks data dump, of the Podesta emails the very next day after the Access Hollywood tape broke, in order to try and help Trump out and take the Access Hollywood story off the headlines.
Yes, of course, we're talking about Julian Assange, and yes, that was just an exquisite bit of timing, wasn't it?
Mm.
You're absolutely right. I think it's very difficult to see any other explanation for the way that all happened, and it was, you know, long known that Assange has contempt for Hillary Clinton, to which he is entitled, but, you know, he's not entitled to work with the Russians to intervene in our election. And that is an important part of the story, you know, the Assange piece of it, that has gotten a shorter shrift in the standard year in review pieces, because, you know, it's now the story is about Putin and about the investigations in the Congress and about the special prosecutor and all of that, and we've kind of sort of forgotten about Assange.
Well, it's interesting to note that at the infamous table at the 10th anniversary of RT's, at which Michael Flynn sat next to Vladimir Putin, and across the table from him was Jill Stein, who was recently interrogated by the Senate Intelligence Committee, and who might well alone have flipped the election for,
that's right,
for Trump in those three key states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Also sitting at that table was Julian Assange's father. So,
you know, I wasn't aware of that, and that's just a stunning fact.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying that it's
stunning fact.
This whole thing's in your face, this Russian Trump story, but...
Well,
this...
none of what the Trump administration, what Trump or his administration is does is, you know, is subtle. There's nothing subtle. I mean, they are robbing the nation blind in front of our faces, and, you know, and laughing while they do it, and the Congress will help them do it, and is helping them do it.
So what's your explanation for that? Because some of them have to know, people like Lindsey Graham, certainly, and McCain and others, they have to know. The United States Intelligence Services, all 16 or whatever, they don't agree on just about anything. There's all kinds of rivalries going on. So when all of them get together and say, yes, this happened,
yeah,
nobody in the government doesn't believe that.
Right.
But somehow these Republicans and these key Tea Party guys are totally in denial. And so I'm wondering why the Republicans who know or who suspect that their president is a traitor are going along with this. Is it because they're afraid of the Bannon wing, or are they just doing damage control, figuring, well, if it comes out that our president and our leader of our party is a traitor, we're going to get wiped out in 2018, and let's see if we can stick with the cover up until then?
Well, I think there's a couple things going on, Ian. I think one is, you know, you're quite right, they are afraid of Bannon, especially in the Senate, where, you know, Bannon has pledged to run primary challenges to virtually every Republican senator.
Right. His choice of candidates is somewhat lacking.
He may have sullied his reputation as a kingmaker with the outcome in the Alabama election. It'll be interesting to see if his sugar daddy, Robert Mercer of the Renaissance Technologies hedge fund fortune, will continue to back him in these quests. But I think the other thing you can't let the Republican establishment off the hook. I mean, they're doing the bidding of their donors, and their donors, and not just the direct donors to their campaigns, but the whole what has become the right-wing Republican project, you know, executed by the likes of the Koch brothers and the DeVosses and people like that. You know, those people are in on the take. Mike Pence is a Koch brothers guy. They basically created him in terms of his political career. Betsy DeVos is in the administration. There's any number of Koch-linked characters in the administration. And And at this point, to be a Republican running for national office requires the backing of the Koch brothers network, at the very least, because they've created this extra party infrastructure that now all the candidates rely on, because it was superior to that of the Republican Party. It was quite clever what the Koch brothers did with that. So the ground game is put out, you know, the voters are turned out by Americans for Prosperity and the evangelical wing. The data operation that is used, voter data, you know, all that number crunching and algorithms and all that stuff that is used to game out who's going to turn out to the polls for your candidate from which neighborhoods. That operation is owned by the Kochs. It's called I-360. These candidates don't even bother to use the RNC's operation anymore. So at this point, you know, the Koch brothers have not yet pulled the plug on Donald Trump. Whether or not they will, I don't know. I have suspected that he may be more vulnerable now that the tax bill has passed. He may be more vulnerable to some wavering by the Koch brothers. But, you know, until they decide he's gotten for them everything they've ever wanted, he remains in place and everybody else is going to fall into line.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Adele Stan, let's turn back to women and how it looks as if the bad guys are no longer winning. They've been winning for most of this year.
Yeah.
I think Alabama was a turning point, and it wasn't just that the good guy won, but the good women got behind him, as you pointed out. The African-American women showed up and did the job. My sense is that you're going to have at least three women running for president on the Democratic side, Amy Klobuchar, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Elizabeth Warren. I don't know on the Republican side. They certainly
You may very, very well have a woman try to challenge.
Oh, I know. I was going to say they're welcome to run Nikki Haley or even Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Oh, dear. I don't know. I can cover that election. That would be so gruesome.
Right. But just in the last minute, what's your sense of the likelihood that someday soon a woman will become president of the United States?
Oh, I don't. It's hard to know how soon. I think it's quite possible. I do worry that I've always felt it was probably more likely that a Republican would be the first woman president. Just, you know, because it's she would be seen as less upending of the social order. So I think that I wish I was a little bit more optimistic. I think a lot depends on how things go for Donald Trump and whether or not he succeeds in smashing the institutions of democracy to the point where he cannot be gotten rid of.
Well, Adele Stan, I thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate your perspective on the year that's ended and your, I'd say, guarded optimism about the year that's ahead of us.
Yes, we must resist. It's always great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She's currently a weekly columnist for The American Prospect and contributor to SiriusXM Progress. And her latest article at The American Prospect is On the Road to Kleptocracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.